Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. So very glad to have you with us. I hope you had a blessed and joyous Easter. Special thanks to my dear friend Tracy Johnson, who filled in for a couple days last week when I was on vacation. It is good to be back down at our Avenue studios. Unfortunately, some very, very bad news over the course of the weekend. We'll talk about the regular crime that occurred, but we have lost in Wisconsin the second and third law enforcement officer now killed this year alone in the line of duty. And it's really a miracle that it's not more than that. You know, we've had story after story after story about individuals who decide to flee from the police. We had the story about the guy who's fleeing from the police, and it's like a bad Western movie, who's firing at the police as they are pursuing him. There are just a lot of bad guys out there that for whatever reason have no regard for the lives of anyone else, including police officers, and they're willing to do anything they can to take it. Well, this story, of course, it comes from northwestern Wisconsin, Barron County, which is, I don't know, about an hour and a half west of Minneapolis and, you know, several hours east of Minneapolis and several hours west of Green Bay. But what happened is Saturday afternoon, about 3:30 in the afternoon, a woman named Emily Breidenbach, who was from the Shetak Police Department, and interestingly enough, her as you read her background, her dad was a police chief in Partyville, and, you know, she had a career that was dedicated to law enforcement. While the details are still emerging, what seems like happened is she conducted what the media always refers to as a routine traffic stop. And the point that I have always made for everybody out there who wants to second guess law enforcement, well, you know, why did the police officer do this or that or the other thing? It's because there is no such thing as a routine traffic stop. You know, you go to pull, a police officer goes to pull somebody over because they're speeding, or because they've got an expired license plate, or because their taillight is out, or because they went through a stop sign, or whatever. And you never know what you are going to come across. You never know when you have the person who's got the body in the trunk, or when you've got the person who's fleeing something. You just never know. There is no such thing as a quote-unquote routine traffic stop. So anyhow, Officer Breidenbach apparently tries to make this stop, and we're again finding out the details. We don't know exactly what happened, but the person in the vehicle who is being stopped decides to pull out a gun and start shooting. And ultimately, Officer Breidenbach, she's killed as a result of this. Then there another officer, this time from the Cameron Police Department, pulls up to provide assistance. His name was Hunter Scheel. And Officer Scheel apparently gets into a continuing gun battle as well with the person who's in this car that was the subject of the quote-unquote routine traffic stop. Officer Scheel is killed as well on the scene. The driver of the vehicle, the shooter, the bad guy, is transported to the hospital. He ultimately dies as well. So we don't have any more details. There's going to be a press conference later today. But this is another one of these situations where if you look at what's going on now and the disdain that some people have for police officers and this desire, and believe me, I get texts from people about this all the time, this desire from people who view police officers as an occupying force or whatever, that this is the type of stuff that law enforcement people face on a daily basis. For most of us, we have good days and bad days. Our bad days are when your card key doesn't work. Our bad days are when, you know, you lose a sale. Our bad days are when your boss yells at you. Our bad days are when something goes wrong. For a police officer, the bad day is when you do not come home at night because you were making a quote-unquote routine traffic stop, and in the process of making that routine traffic stop, somebody pulls out a gun and shoots you. That's the difference in this job, and it's something that we all have to keep in mind when we all want to be so very judgmental towards police officers. We'll discuss that more, I'm sure, later on this week as more details emerge. Right now, let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, I want to talk about this national, actually this international story that's probably the biggest story of the week. It might be the biggest story of the year. Somebody or bodies have committed treason, and what they have done to the United States, it is difficult, if not impossible, to describe how big a deal this is. Stick around. That's where we pick it up. This is Jeff Wagner, WTMJ.
Back for more. Here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
So, very glad to have you with us. Okay, let's take a historical step back to launch into what is going on now. If you are of a certain age, you can remember the whole controversy involving the Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers were reports that the United States government had authorized over the years detailing the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia, Vietnam. And it went back to, actually, I think probably the Truman years and certainly the Eisenhower years and then the Kennedy years and then when Lyndon Johnson was president and then the Nixon years. What happened is there was a researcher named Daniel Ellsberg who had access to these documents. And he was aware of the fact that these documents indicated that what the U.S. government was telling the American public about involvement in Southeast Asia was not the truth. And so what Daniel Ellsberg did is he developed this systematic way, and they would take these documents out in the middle of the night. He'd smuggle them out, and they'd photocopy them, and ultimately he made them available to the press. But in the case of the Pentagon Papers, what it was an historical analysis of how the U.S. got into Southeast Asia and quite frankly, the lies that the administrations, various administrations had told to the American public. You know, they're saying, okay, well, this is what we think is, you know, this is why we're doing this. But then these papers suggested that really wasn't the case. But it was damaging. It was embarrassing. But it was an historical analysis of this. You know, over the last couple years, you've had reports. WikiLeaks, remember? WikiLeaks spilled a huge trove of State Department cables about 13 years ago, giving the world a sense of what American diplomats do each day. All right, but this was, again, it wasn't a real-time sort of thing. It was, okay, this is how American diplomats, you know, handle things. 3 years after that, Edward Snowden, remember him? He took National Security Agency secrets 3 years later and then released them, and it showed that the degree of surveillance that we now had was being undertaken by the National Security Agency. But again, it was more of an historical sort of thing that indicated day-to-day operations as opposed to more than that. What's going on now is completely and totally different. What happened in early January, and these documents have been out there, is that somewhere on this weird little, you know, website that's out there, there's a small message board that's called Discord. And sometime in January, somebody began to post files on this small message board. The files were labeled as top secret. But they provide real-time current information, details about the war in Ukraine, intercepted communications about U.S. allies like Israel and South Korea, and details of American penetration of Russian military plans. These were real-time documents showing, you know, what the U.S. is doing on Tuesday, for example. And this is, okay, this is how we're monitoring Russia, and this is the information we're having that we're providing to Ukraine. These are not historical documents. They are real-time, real-world analysis of what is going on. And candidly, I mean, it puts the U.S. in a somewhat bad light because they are critical of some of our allies and things like that. But again, it's talking about, like, daily operations. All right, the evidence is overwhelming that this was not a hacking thing. This wasn't like somebody was able to penetrate Department of Defense records. This was instead, it was a leak. Why do they know it was a leak? Well, the material, again, it's popping up on these various message boards, on these various message boards. But what is being circulated are photographs of printed briefing reports. In other words, they look like hastily taken photographs of pieces of paper sitting atop what appears to be a hunting magazine. And the theory is that it looks like a classified briefing paper was folded up, placed in somebody's pocket, smuggled out of a secure area, and then photographed. The documents, many of them, not all of them, but many of them, are specifically marked for U.S. eyes only, which increases the likelihood that an American official leaked the information. So I think the working theory and what appears to be what's going on here is that you have somebody who had access to this very, very current and very, very top secret information that is relevant to how the U.S. is conducting its foreign affairs and its the war in Ukraine. Somebody smuggled these documents out, took photographs of them, and then started putting them out on these message boards. Now, part of the scary thing is this apparently started in January, and nobody really paid much attention to it until a couple weeks ago when it started to get much wider scale dissemination. But it's out there now, and the damage that it is doing to the United States, both in terms of prestige among the allies, but also in day-to-day compromising of U.S. operations, particularly in the war in Ukraine, is staggering. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. The FBI has apparently made this a priority. I guess I have a couple issues. First of all, how bad is this? I mean, I think on a scale of 1 to 10, that this is a full-blown 9 and it's maybe a 10. Whoever did this, in my opinion, is guilty of treason. This is not some historical thing that we need to shed light on the U.S. government that's been misrepresenting, you know, the history of the war in Southeast Asia. This is an incredible breach of intelligence. And the effect of this is to damage us, perhaps cost lives moving forward. And quite candidly, it's going to be tough for the U.S. to come back from this. 855-616-1620. Whoever did this is, in my opinion, is a traitor. This investigation needs to be a top priority. It's also amazing to me that it's almost amazing that this could happen. That, you know, somebody could be able to get access to these documents and be able to do this. This is an incredibly big deal. I see this as a 9 on a scale of 10. It needs to be a top priority. They need to identify who did this. You can't put the genie back in the bottle, but you can certainly find the person who did this. And my guess is there's just a limited number of people who have access to all this information, but that person needs to be identified, prosecuted, and then warehoused for the rest of his or her life. 855-616-1620. How big a deal is this? To me, it's a 9 out of 10, and I might be underplaying it. We discuss in just a moment.
You're listening to Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
855-616-1620, which is the Old National Bank talk and text line. It is, in my opinion, impossible to underestimate what a big deal these leaks are. More so, I think, than any other leak that we've had, because if you start to look at what's been put out there on the internet, you see, first of all, these leaked documents from the Pentagon, they reveal how deeply the United States has been able to compromise Russian security and intelligence services, which has allowed Washington to warn Ukraine about planned strikes and gain insight into Moscow's, what they're calling the war machine. So, you know, this shows that the U.S. has these various intelligence capabilities, at least had the capabilities, but now this is out in public. You got to figure out that Russia is going to be objecting to this. But it's not just Ukraine. That these documents apparently also include sensitive briefing material on Canada, on China, on Israel, on South Korea, in addition to the Middle East. So this is somebody with access to the most confidential, real-time sort of documents has now put this all out there, And the effect, I don't know that there's anything in there that embarrasses the U.S. per se, other than the fact that it demonstrates that the U.S. isn't able to keep secrets anymore. And it raises this question among all our allies. How can you trust dealing with the United States if, you know, next thing you know, you think you're having, confidential communications or whatever, and all of a sudden they end up on some, weird website and out there for the public to see. Jeff, unfortunately, it seems as though somebody has an axe to grind with the current administration and wants to embarrass it. Whoever needs to do this needs to be prosecuted to the full extent of our espionage laws. Yeah, I mean, who knows what the motivation is? Is it to embarrass the Biden administration? I don't know about that. But I know that this is a really, really big deal. Jeff, isn't every country doing the same to each other? Maybe they are. But this is the U.S.'s information, which is now out in public for everybody to see, not only what they're doing, but how they are going about doing it, which is, of course, a huge issue. And then, of course, a couple of our texters who can't get past the Donald Trump hatred. You know, when is Donald Trump going to be charged with treason? This has nothing to do with Trump. I'm sure there's some people out there that want to try to find a reason to blame Trump for everything. But that's not the case here. You got to get past the Trump situation. You got to start focusing on what happened here and what the compromise is.
Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
King Joe Biden is at it again. Now, we've talked in this program in the past about this desire to kill the internal combustion engine, get everybody out of traditional cars and force people into electric vehicles. My point all along has been, if you want to buy an electric vehicle, that's fine. Go ahead and buy an electric vehicle. And at some point in time, the different issues that exist with electric vehicles will be overcome to the point that maybe it'll make economic sense for people to do that. I object to the idea that taxpayers are underwriting the cost of electric vehicles for people who make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. But I quibble with that. But that's perhaps a quibble. The reality is that electric vehicles, as they exist now, in my opinion, are not practical for many drivers. If you want to use your car to, putter around town or something like that, that's fine. But if you, for example, want to use your vehicle to drive from Milwaukee to Florida, it's not practical for a number of reasons. For example, the estimates are the average range of a 2021 gasoline vehicle, 403 miles. So you could go 403 miles on a tank of gas. You could stop. How long does it take you to, you pull away, pull to a roadside gas station, you go to the bathroom, you get yourself a cup of coffee, you come back, it takes you maybe 5 minutes to fill the car up again, and then you're on your way. The average range of a 2021 electric vehicle, 234 miles. And of course, as we all know, you can't recharge an electric vehicle in 5 minutes. You can't fully recharge an electric vehicle in 5 hours. So what are people going to do? You want to drive your car long distances. You've got to find a charging station. You want to pull over, and then you're going to sit for hours at a time. It's just not practical. The cost, the average cost of an electric vehicle, 2021, $64,000. The average cost of a compact gas-powered car, $26,000. So electric vehicles are still a very, very pricey alternative. Now, I know people who have electric vehicles. They love them. But they also have regular vehicles as well that they use for other than like around town driving. Whenever I do this, I always get an email from somebody who says, well, I had no problem. I was able to drive from Milwaukee to Minneapolis. Okay, good on you that you were able to do that. But then your car has to sit overnight and it has to charge. My only point is, for the majority of us, electric vehicles are extremely expensive and they are not practical. Maybe somewhere along the line, They'll take care of that. But we're not close to that stage right now. So why are we talking about this? Because on Wednesday, Joe Biden's Environmental Protection Agency is going to roll out rules which will essentially make it extremely difficult for you to purchase a new car that is not an all-electric vehicle. And by the way, I'm not even talking about hybrids now. We're not talking about hybrids. We're talking about all-electric vehicles. Here's the story. The Biden administration Wednesday, again, through executive order, this isn't going through Congress at all, is planning to roll out what they describe as the most stringent auto pollution limits in the world, which are designed to ensure that all electric cars will make up as much as two-thirds, 67%, of all new passenger vehicles sold in the country by 2032. That is within the next 9 years. Now, you could pass these rules. As they're saying, it's, first of all, going to be a huge challenge to automakers because no car company has committed to this level envisioned by the Biden administration because it's just not practical. Several that are trying to convert and produce more electric vehicles, well, they've got huge supply chain problems that are there. But this requirement would ensure that electric cars represent between 54 and 60% of all new cars sold in the United States by 2030. That's in the next 7 years, and would be 67% by 2032. You want to buy a gasoline-powered car, you are essentially going to be out of luck, or the costs are going to be absolutely huge to end up doing this. Our number, 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Now, this is, of course, all being done to appease the climate warriors who hate the internal combustion engine. At some point in time, like I say, the marketplace is going to take over, and electric vehicles, all electric vehicles, will make sense. We're not close to that, and we're not going to be close to that in 5 or 6 years. But that is precisely what Biden is trying to do. He doesn't care about the free market, doesn't care about what your tastes are. The idea is we are going to force American consumers out of their internal combustion engines into all electric vehicles. Again, we're not even talking about hybrids, simply by use of rules without having to go through Congress at all. Our number, 855-616-1620, that is the Old National Bank talk and text line. The more people find out about this, the more I am convinced that they will simply not accept this. If Congress wants to do it, well, you know you couldn't get it through Congress because you know the vast majority of elected officials, Republicans, Democrats, wouldn't sign off on this. This is nothing but a big, sloppy, wet kiss to the environmental lobby. And the result of that is it's going to be devastating, I think, for the American economy and certainly to individual consumers. And by the way, it's not going to make a whit of difference overall with climate because you've got China, you've got India, which are going industrialized. And what are they doing? They're using coal, for goodness sakes. But we're going to force Americans out of the cars that we love, into technology, which is questionable, into vehicles that for most of us are not practical and are way, way, way too expensive. And don't call me up and tell me that you love your electric vehicle. If you love your electric vehicle, that's great. About 5.5% of the vehicles that were sold in the United States last year were all electric vehicles. If you want to buy an all electric vehicle, go with God. That's fine. But I don't believe the government should be forcing the rest of us who have all sorts of concerns about electric vehicles out of our cars. And I still haven't heard anybody explain where the electricity is going to come from. The electric grid right now is a mess. If 60 to 70% of the people who are driving vehicles now have to charge your vehicles up every night, how in God's green earth are we going to produce the electricity that is going to power those cars? 855-616-1620. We discuss in just a moment.
Welcome back to Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
Yep, Wednesday, King Joe Biden and his EPA are about ready to roll out these rules, which will essentially force automakers to stop making internal combustion cars. The rules will require about 60% of the vehicles, new vehicles sold in this country by 2030 to be all electric. Not even hybrid, but all electric, and two-thirds by 2032. First of all, this is crazy, and nobody is explaining why okay, what's going to happen here? You know, where are we going to get the, we're going to need millions of new electric vehicle charging stations. Millions of them in the next 7 or 8 years. You're going to need a complete overhaul of the electric grids to accommodate the power needs of those chargers. And how are those grids going to be overhauled? And where is the power going to come from? How are we going to, I don't know, quintuple the amount of energy that we are producing now? Are we going to go with nuclear plants? We're certainly not going to use coal anymore because that's a problem. You know, fossil fuels, where is all this going to come from? And by the way, where are we going to get the supplies of minerals and other materials needed for batteries? And that's just part of the problem without going into the failings of electric vehicles. Now, again, whenever I talk about this, I get texts from people who have an electric vehicle and love it. Oh, this is great. I love mine. Go with God. That's okay. You know, 5.8% or 5.5% of the new vehicles sold in this country last year were all electric. That's fine. You want to buy an all-electric vehicle, that's great. I have an issue with whether the rest of us taxpayers should be underwriting your decision to do that. But if it works for you, if you're used to puttering around town and you don't need to have a car to drive halfway across the country, or, you know, you have access to chargers. A lot of people are saying, hey, I live in an apartment. What's going to happen? I don't know. I don't know, but the Biden administration doesn't know. Nobody knows about this because it's just something that is being, you know, thrown at people and told, okay, you're just going to have to adapt. Well, I'm not ready to give up my internal combustion car right now. Maybe at some point in time it'll make sense, but certainly not yet. Let's start with Tom in Sun Prairie. Tom, you're on WTMJ.
Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Tom.
You got me all riled up. You got me all riled up this morning over this thing. My wife and I are recently retired, and we winter out in Arizona. And we road trip out, Jeff. We take our time, but we get there in 3 days to our place in Arizona. I'm just doing some calculating here, as it's going to take us roughly now 6 days to get out if we have to go with an electric vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to have extra lodging.
Yep.
Our costs are going to basically double, Jeff. And, you know, Jeff, the other thing, coming back and going through this year, the motorhomes that are on these highways, there are as many as tractor trailers now. And
yep.
What are they going to do with the motorhome situation?
I
think it's an absolutely stupid idea, Jeff.
You know, Tom, thanks for calling. Well, you're right. See, we're just not ready for this at this point in time. But this idea, and see, these are the questions. Nobody says, okay, how are, in the next 7 years, where are the millions of, literally millions of charging stations going to come from? And to the point you were making and the point I was making is somebody who occasionally drives back and forth from Florida. Okay, it's to get from my place here to my place in Florida is, roughly, I don't know, 1,400 miles. You can do it with one stop, you know, one overnight stop. I guess you could do it going through. But, you know, imagine what's going to happen if you only get 250 or 300 miles on a charge. And that's on a good day. That's not driving in the winter where you're blasting the heater. It's not where you've got everything else going on. But, okay, so you drive your 200, your 250 miles, and then you have to find a charging station, and then you have to hope that you can. You're not in line at the charging station, and then you're going to sit there for 3, 4, 5, 10, 12 hours. It is crazy. Now, maybe at some point in time this will be an alternative, but to have the government force this through down our throats is ridiculous. And again, as I said earlier, it's not going to make a darn bit of difference. In the overall scheme of things, this is nothing but an attempt to placate the eco-warriors, the climate change activists, and say, hey, we're doing something. But unless you can get China and India to stop building coal plants, give me a break. 855-616-1620. Jeff, first, one of our texters says, I cover 10 Midwest states for my job. There's no charging infrastructure. Where in remote Indiana am I going to charge my cars? Second, to your point, where is the electricity coming from? If we burn more coal, we poison the atmosphere with tons of mercury. 855-616-1620. Let's talk to Josh in Lake Geneva. Josh, you're on WTMJ.
Hi. I'd just like to point out the fact that these large shipping containers that are going back and forth between China and California, the 8 largest ones, pollute more than all of the cars in the world combined. They run on bunk fuel, which is pretty much the the grossest thing that we can use to run these ships. I don't know why no one ever speaks about that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, thanks, Nicole. I mean, it's one of these things where, again, it sounds good. I appreciate the idea that you want to try to increase mileage limits. One of the questions I ask is, what's happened to hybrids? I mean, seriously, these rules, I'm not talking about hybrids. These rules will essentially force, two-thirds of the new automobiles that are sold to be electric vehicles. And again, you want to talk about regressive. My guess is the price of the remaining one-third of internal combustion engine cars, they're going to be priced very, very high, and they're going to be outside the price range of most people. But again, I'm a free market guy. Let the market develop. And there will be a point, I think, when electric vehicles become competitive. I don't think it's going to be in the next 5 years. I don't think it's going to be in the next 10 years. I don't know when it's going to be. So far, despite the fact that the automobile companies are investing billions, B as in billions of dollars, in trying to develop this, so far that they haven't been able to get that done. But the bottom line is that there'll be a time when this takes off. I question whether or not the government should be telling us, hey, you got to get out of your internal combustion engines. When did this become the government's right? Again, and I understand there's some of the climate warriors out there who say, well, I drive an electric vehicle, and I've got my Prius, and, I ride my bicycle around, and you don't love the planet if you do anything other than that. Oh, give me a break. I mean, for goodness sakes, these self-righteous people who've decided that, all right, we know better than everybody else, and we're superior because we can drive our $125,000 Teslas. The average person, who's driving their $25,000 or $30,000 compact car and who's still, getting 30, 35 miles a gallon, they're not people that hate the planet. They're just people who recognize that this is where the state of technology is. And this notion that the government knows better and Joe Biden knows better, and we don't have to present it to Congress, we're just going to use the EPA rulemaking authority to do this. Well, I'm going to tell you something. We've got elections coming up in 2024, and that is the one thing, when you don't do it by law, when you just do it by executive fiat, you have the government come in and say, we're going to do this. Well, the next administration can undo this, and I guarantee you, when Biden rolls this out and the EPA pushes it, this, I believe, will be a major issue moving forward. Keep in mind, if you want to keep your car, your regular old-fashioned car that runs on, heaven forbid, unleaded gas, well, you better be thinking about that, because if Joe Biden gets his way, you're not, most of us at least, aren't going to be in our cars or aren't going to be able to buy new cars starting in 2030. And if you don't think that's going to be an election issue, well, I think you're missing the boat big time. Back with more in just a minute. This is Jeff Wagner. Here's a text. Jeff, good ideas don't need to be mandated. If it was economical and desired by consumers for companies to make all electric vehicles, they'd be doing so without the government forcing them. To which I say, amen. Amen. That's it. Where does the government get this interest to try to say, okay, we know better than the free market, and we're going to force this on people? And look, stuff happens from time to time. For the longest time, first of all, you had vinyl records. And then you had, you had cassette tapes, and then you had CDs, and the population moved. Oh, the CDs are superior to the cassettes, and they're superior to the vinyl records. And I understand there's some people that still have that as a niche market, but you get the point. And then it's like, okay, streaming. So nobody needs CDs anymore. The market adjusts. Same thing is true. Videotapes. First of all, you had VHS tapes, and then you had Blu-ray discs, and now everybody just streams stuff. The market adapts. Consumers follow. You do not need the Biden administration saying, we know better, and what we're going to do is we want to appease all the climate warriors out there, so this is what we're going to do. We're going to mess over everybody who's driving in an automobile. You're going to have to drive electric vehicles. We have no idea how the grid is going to work. We have no idea where the millions of charging stations are going to come from. We have no idea to tell you what to do when it takes you 12 hours to recharge your car. But don't worry, we're the government. Just trust us. I don't think so. When we come back, some tough love. Stick around.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the program. Hey, if you follow me on Twitter, it's at JeffWagner620. I had a number of postings over the last week, and we're going to use a couple of those as launching points for our discussion this hour. But there's one I wanted to call your attention to. You probably heard the saying, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. Well, I've got a classic example of that. Now, we've talked a couple times about this. Down in Atlanta, they're building a new police training center, all right? And this is on public land, and it's going to be like a justice facility, and it's going to have like spots for, you know, training areas for law enforcement and things like that. For whatever reason, this has become the target, that this training center, which is being built in these woods, it has become the target for every Antifa crazy in the United States who has decided that we hate the cops and, you know, we're part of the defund the police movement and we don't want the police, you know, building this facility where police officers can be trained, et cetera, et cetera. So every crazy, imagine a bathtub full of water. And imagine instead of water, that bathtub is full of just complete and total left-wing crazies. And imagine then pulling out the stopper and all of them go swirling down the drain and you wonder where it comes out. Well, it comes out in Atlanta. And so like every Antifa crazy has descended on Atlanta and has made this thing like we're going to try to occupy these woods and we're going to try to stop this training center from being built. Well, about a month ago, it escalated. And what you had on March 5th, you had a bunch of people who attacked, they put on the black masks and attacked the site in a wooded area, throwing flaming bottles and rocks at the police, trying to blind officers by shining green lasers into their eyes, using tires and debris to block a road. You know, the typical sort of like crazy tactics. The interesting thing, at least one of the interesting things to me about this, is almost everybody that they caught and who arrested were from out of state. This isn't a local protest. It's not like, gee, you've got a bunch of people in Atlanta who, you know, care about this. My guess is the vast majority of people in Atlanta think this is probably a pretty good idea. But this is this national, you know, we want to try to find something to protest and we want to try to find something to disrupt. And so we're going to come from all over the country. So of the 23 people that got arrested for this latest disturbance in early March, I think 21 were from out of state. And we've talked about this before. But I mean, again, you've got people coming from Oregon, you've got people coming from California, and as it turns out, you have two people coming from Wisconsin. According to the Wisconsin State Journal, one of the people is a 22-year-old woman named Grace Martin. Another is a 19-year-old woman named Kaylee Meissner. Now, I've got a link to this story. Again, if you follow me on Twitter, it's at JeffWagner620. They've got their pictures in the paper. They got their booking photos in the paper, and they show them. And I've always careful about this because you cannot judge a book by its cover. There's a reason for that cliche. However, if you were trying to imagine what two young women looked like who decided they were going to travel from Madison, Wisconsin to Atlanta, Georgia to put on masks and take part in a disruption. If you were trying to wonder what they would look like, you know, they look like what you would imagine them to look like. So here's the story in the State Journal. Two Madison women are among 23 people facing possible domestic terrorism charges in Georgia after they allegedly participated in a violent protest at a site outside Atlanta where a police training center is being built. Grace Martin, 22, and Kaylee Meissner, 19, face at least 5 years in prison and as many as 35 if formally charged and then convicted. So they were arrested. The grand jury hasn't issued charges yet, but if convicted under a Georgia statute for participating in the March 5th attack on the future site of the Atlanta Public Safety Center, what has been dubbed as Cop City. Both were booked into the DeKalb County, Georgia jail on March 5th. Martin, that would be the 22-year-old, posted $5,000 bail and was released March 21st. Meissner was bailed out on March 17th. The records don't indicate for how much. So again, the grand jury hasn't convened on this yet, and so they haven't been formally charged, although they were arrested. But the point I was trying to make in my Twitter account and my Twitter feed was that, you know, you have some self-entitled dilettantes from Madison who travel allegedly to Georgia to play Antifa, and now they're looking at potentially decades in prison. This is the very definition of the old saying, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. So to me, this is this whole idea, and this is what's going on around the country, where, again, you have these self-entitled people who decide, hey, you know, I'm going to travel. It's not like I can find stuff I want to protest about in Madison, Wisconsin. So I'm going to travel to Georgia. I'm going to put on a black mask, if that's what they did, and I'm going to get myself involved in this violent protest. Well, that's fine if you make that decision, but understand that when you do that, when you play that stupid game, you might end up winning that stupid prize, which is 5, 10, 15, 20 years in prison for domestic terrorism. No sympathy from me. All right. Tough love. I was off last week, so I did not have an opportunity to comment on the election. And as Connie Weber was talking about in the newscast, it's no secret. The ideological balance on the Supreme Court has shifted. The liberal candidate, Janet Protasiewicz, backed by millions and millions of dollars of out-of-state money, won overwhelmingly over the conservative candidate, Dan Kelly. Now, this is not a surprise to any of us who were watching this race. And I guess I have a couple comments and then a specific aspect of this that I want to talk about. Okay, first of all, I really do wonder, you know, what would have happened if this is now the second statewide election in a few months where I think the candidates who have been chosen in the primaries, whether it was the Republican primary for governor or the Supreme Court primary, where the conservative candidates, the conservatives or the Republicans, ended up voting for the candidate who had less appeal in the general election. I mean, I wonder what would have happened if Rebecca Clayfish and Jennifer Doro had been the candidates instead of the candidates the Democrats pushed for in the primary. So that's issue number one. But let's deal with the elephant in the room. And matter of fact, I sent out a tweet that got, I'm just looking at over 15,000, you know, impressions. Here are two uncomfortable truths I think that Republicans need to grasp in Wisconsin when it comes to statewide elections. I'm going to share them and I want comments on this. First of all, if conservatives keep bypassing the more electable candidates in the primaries, like Clayfish and Doro, they're going to continue to struggle statewide. That's number one. But number two, and this is the uncomfortable truth that I have been bringing up for a while now, at least for the last year since the Supreme Court threw out Roe versus Wade, a reasonable accommodation for elective abortion needs to be reached. In the governor's race, abortion was a driving issue for turnout. In the Supreme Court race, abortion was the driving issue for turnout. Now, I'm not saying Dan Kelly would have won. Tim Michaels might have had a better chance. I think Kelly was a very, very flawed candidate, and that was the point I was trying to make for a long time. But here's the issue. I don't care how you feel about abortion. Maybe you think it's murder and nobody should be allowed to get abortions. And I respect that moral position. But the reality is that is not where the overwhelming majority of Wisconsin voters are. The overwhelming majority of Wisconsin voters believe that certainly in cases of rape or incest, women should have the opportunity to get abortions, and that there should be a reasonable accommodation for elective abortions. Now, I don't know if that's 14 weeks or 16 weeks. Tony Evers wants 20 weeks. But the overwhelming majority of Wisconsin voters, including young voters, including young women, and suburban moderate, and what I would describe as independent suburban women, who are always going to be the key to statewide elections, they believe that there should be some accommodation for elective abortions. Until the legislature realizes this and says, okay, we're going to come out with a law that's going to allow you know, rape, incest, and elective abortions. And again, pick a day, 14 weeks, 16 weeks. I don't know what that is. I'll let smarter people than me figure that out. But until that happens, Republicans are going to lose, conservatives are going to lose statewide because abortion right now is the dominant issue. That is the uncomfortable truth that is out there. But how many more elections do conservatives need to lose before people wake up and realize that? Okay, let's discuss. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line.
Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Okay, this is this uncomfortable truth, and that is that conservatives and Republicans have to figure out a reasonable accommodation on elective abortions. That's just the truth. And until that happens, you're going to continue to lose statewide elections. Now, I'm not saying Dan Kelly would have beaten Janet Protasiewicz anyways. I think there were other issues going on, but abortion is a dominant issue in this state right now. It's turning out huge numbers of young people. And it's turning out, again, huge numbers of independent voters who might otherwise vote Republican, but they're choosing to vote on the abortion issue alone. Now, one of our texters says, Jeff, the problem, abortion is murder, plain and simple. And my response was, I respect your position, but the problem is that 70% of the people don't agree with you. And this is why abortion becomes so complex. Your views on abortion depend on your personal religious experience, your faith. It depends on your life experience. And even then, you raise the issue of, okay, just because abortion, you believe it's murder, you know, other people see it differently. But that doesn't change the reality that this is, from an electoral perspective, it is an absolute loser. And let me give you another uncomfortable truth that is one of the things that's frustrating to me. Okay, Wisconsin has this 1849 law which bans abortion. That has not stopped a single Wisconsin woman who wanted an abortion from getting an abortion. Jeff, what do you mean? Well, Illinois allows abortions. Minnesota allows abortions. Any woman in Wisconsin who wants an abortion simply has to travel to Illinois and to Minnesota and to Michigan to have the abortion performed. And if you don't think that is happening, you're incredibly naive. So by enforcing this law, you're not stopping a single person from having an abortion. You are making it a little bit more difficult for them to do it, but we're not accomplishing anything at all. And that's why we're at a point where, if you want to talk about a national ban, a national law banning abortion, which I don't think would be constitutional, but regardless, then you have that conversation. But for Wisconsin to be the island when it comes to abortion in the Midwest, an issue that 70%+ of the people think that there should be some accommodation for, starting with rape and incest, and then for, again, I don't know what the 12, 14, 16, 18, pick a time limit, have that debate. But this is an opportunity, I think, for Republicans to take the initiative and come out and say, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to try to, in some way, shape, or form, codify Roe versus Wade, and we're going to 12 weeks, 14 weeks, whatever it is, rape and incest, and then if people want to argue, no, we need to justify late-term abortions, okay, let's have that discussion. But this continues to be an electoral loser for people. And I understand, and I know many people who are militantly pro-life. I respect that position, but the truth of the matter is that's not where the population is. Jeff, I couldn't agree with you more. Until the conservatives figure this out regarding abortion, come up with some reasonable solutions with regard to guns, begin to capitalize on the strategies that Democrats are currently using, et cetera, they're going to continue to lose. Republicans better adapt, or they're going to become extinct. Jeff, let's see. Our OBGYN residents cannot train here in medical technology because of the particular law. Let's see. I think, you know, here's, and a number of people are just coming front. Jeff, you're right. Women from Wisconsin are traveling to other states for abortions, but all women in Wisconsin do not have the resources to do that. Do not say that the law has not stopped any woman from getting an abortion. Well, I haven't. No, I'm going to stand by that because there's a number of organizations that will fund people to travel interstate. And I have not seen one news report of any woman who has claimed that, gee, I did not get an abortion because it wasn't around in Wisconsin. Now, maybe that's happening, but again, it's not happening in any great sort of numbers. Jeff, 95% of all abortions happen before 13 weeks. You think the people who spent 50 years and millions of dollars will accept a 5% reduction? Again, we can argue about where the line is to be drawn, but this is the issue. And I have lots of conservative friends who I've met over the years, and even people who are appalled at the idea of abortion and who believe that it's wrong and they would never consider, you know, an abortion for themselves or whatever, they understand that that is not where the electorate is. And so that's just the reality. It's a good topic. I've been with my wife for over 30 years, and this is the first time that my wife and my adult daughter encouraged me to vote a certain way on that issue. I think you just got to understand this. And when you see these results over and over and over again, and you don't make any changes to this. Now, again, I understand the governor's race has multiple issues. I understand the Supreme Court race has multiple issues. I get all that. But if you don't think abortion was a dominant issue across the country, you have Democrats who are running, and there's in races that has nothing to do with abortion at all. And they're running on a pro-abortion sort of platform, and they are succeeding. We've got to figure out a way to move beyond this issue. Now, maybe it's going to happen when the Supreme Court strikes down the 1849 law, which is going to, I don't know what happens after that and happens. Maybe that means the issue ends up going away as an electoral force. But I think the more appropriate way to do it would be let's figure out where the population is. Let's recognize this, and then let's put this issue behind us. And then let's say, look, what we want to do is we want to, you know, win people's hearts and minds. And the pro-life movement needs to encourage people to choose adoption or choose all other alternatives to abortion. But the idea that you're going to try to ban it, it's just not where the overwhelming population of the state is. And I understand that is uncomfortable for some people to hear, but I'm all about telling uncomfortable truths as long as they're truths. Back with more in just a minute. This is Jeff Wagner.
Welcome back to Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
One of our texters says, Jeff, didn't you see that story in the local newspaper where GOP leadership says it's about more than abortion? And yeah, I did. As a matter of fact, I sent out a tweet on that. If the GOP leadership thinks that the statewide losses were more due to logistics and strategy than to abortion, they're on drugs. It's this refusal to confront reality. Those are the same people that probably think it was a good idea to give Aaron Rodgers a $59 million guaranteed contract for this year. Now, here's the bottom line. You got to get past the abortion issue, period.
You're listening to Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
If you are a regular listener to this program, you know that I have been following the ongoing saga of Northridge Shopping Center for years and years and years. Now part of this is that I grew up in Glendale, and I mean, I can remember as a kid, as a teenager, I can remember going to Northridge in its heyday, and when they had a movie theater that had six different screens, and friends of mine, you know, worked at a number of the restaurants that were out there, and it was the place. If you grew up in the North Shore during a certain period of time, like when I did, Northridge was a place that you went to hang out in. And for a variety of reasons, Northridge went into one of these spirals, and it ended up going downhill. And it's essentially Northridge as a commercial shopping center died a long time ago. You have this very, very bad company. Black Spruce, that purchased Northridge, and their idea was they were going to turn this into an Asian trademark, you know, and people, really smart people I know who know a lot about real estate development, they always said that this was never, it was, it was never a realistic idea in the beginning, and it certainly, as time went on and the property deteriorated, it got worse and worse. And so we all know Northridge has turned into this kind of like giant urban, suburban, I guess, cesspool, where it's in decay. You have, you know, somebody who lost their life there. You've had people breaking in, setting arson fires. It's been a mess. And the city, to its credit, has been fighting these battles to try to, you know, tear it down. But the city's concern has been, well, if we're going to try to tear this down, if we're going to, like, foreclose on it, take it over and tear it down, it's going to cost us millions of dollars. And then we're going to be stuck with this property. What do we end up doing with it? So at the last minute, company called Phoenix Investors, which is a Milwaukee firm that has, their modus operandi, and by the way, this is a good company. This is a well-respected company. And what they do is they operate in about 30 states, and what they do is they come in and they buy run-down distressed properties like Northridge, and they buy them for pennies on the dollar, and then what they do is they revamp them. Oh, okay, you know, but that's fine. So they have swooped in, and you know they've said, okay, we're going to buy Northridge. We're going to take it. You know, what we'll do is we'll start doing what the previous owner should have done. We'll start, you know, making sure that there's security around there. But our ultimate plans for us to buy this is we want to, you know, take this space, and we want to take about 1 million square feet, and we want to convert it into industrial storage and warehousing. And then, you know, we also, you know, want to take some space, hoping that there's going to be some light industrial development. You know, so again, some not major manufacturing, but some light industry. But they want to use it for storage and warehousing and things like that. But they're going to clean it up, and they're going to turn it into something that is functional. Oh, all right. Good idea, right? Because it's been just a disaster for the last couple decades. Well, into this, the wrench in the plans now is that city officials are saying, well, wait, we're not sure that we're going to do this. We're not sure that we're going to give you the zoning changes that you need. So you're coming in, you're going to spend millions of dollars of your own money, whatever, and you're going to take over this property that has been an eyesore, and you're going to convert it. But the city is saying, we don't like what you're converting it to. Here's what one of the spokespeople says. We recognize Phoenix Investors' long-standing business of converting former vacant commercial buildings for warehousing, distribution, and storage. All right? However, the city of Milwaukee will not support a development at Northridge Mall location anchored by industrial storage with ancillary light industrial at this time. The mayor's administration won't recommend a zoning change to allow storage. And they say that's because industrial storage does not promote meaningful job growth. It is not compatible with the community's redevelopment goals based on past public visioning sessions. Okay, our number is 855-616-1620, which is our talk and text line. Look, this is one where I admit, again, I'm glad that my producer Isaac today is sitting behind a glass wall, because my head is getting ready to explode. Northridge is a disaster. It has been, like I said, a suburban cesspool. There's been nothing going on there for 20 years. In a perfect world, all right, you would love to see Northridge thrive as a shopping mall. If you could turn back the clock to 1984 and say, hey, we're going to snap our fingers and Northridge is going to be like the Northridge of 1984 was, and you're going to have movie theaters, and you're going to have restaurants, and you're going to have retail, and you're going to have people from all over the five-county area flocking to Northridge to patronize it, I'd say great. But this is not 1984. This idea that, hey, we're the city, and we think it should be something else other than light industrial and storage. Well, okay, explain to me what that is going to be. Because the truth is, the private sector hasn't been able to find anything to make that work for 20-some years. To kill this deal So the city of Milwaukee would then be back to square one, saying the city will take millions of dollars of money that it doesn't have, level Northridge, raise it, and then try to figure out something to do. Makes no sense at all. This is, to use the cliche, this is the bird in the hand. This is, at least at this moment, 2023, this is the best use of that space. And if the city is stupid enough to kill this deal by not going ahead with a zoning change, well, the city deserves what it gets, because you kill this deal and then it's going to continue to deteriorate, if that is at all possible. The mayor, members of the Common Council should be on their hands and knees thanking Phoenix Investments for coming along and taking this albatross off the hands of the previous owners and removing it as a problem for the city of Milwaukee. Is this the ideal use? Well, no, like I say, in a perfect world, you'd love to have this be a thriving community. You'd love to have it be the Northridge of 1984. But that's just not realistic. 855-616-1620. The stupidity that is going on at City Hall in connection with this is, to me, mind-boggling. Mike on the Northwest Side. Mike, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, good afternoon, Jeff. I agree with you wholeheartedly. These doofuses in Milwaukee City Hall better take this deal, or they're going to take another, be looking at that eyesore for another couple of decades. And if they do build this light industrial stuff, there's going to be a, you know, maybe a restaurant or a grocery store popping up around it, because people are going to work there and want to do that, shopping there.
Well,
they're going to take it, or they're going to be looking at an eyesore forever.
Well, yeah, right. Mike. I mean, because what is the alternative? I mean, it's been in this situation for decades. This Black Spruce operation hasn't been able to find any takers. And where is the developer that's going to come along and say, I'm going to invest $50 million, $100 million, whatever that cost is going to be, to try to turn this into a shopping center? It's just not realistic. This is the bird in the hand. Take it. Say thank you. Declare victory and move on.
Absolutely.
Thanks for calling. I mean, and it is aggravating that you see this, that, you know, the city of Milwaukee is once again, you know, willing to, you know, screw up this thing. Jeff, I think that they should use it as a prison. Well, okay. That is apparently not in the plans. The city of Milwaukee has decided on, the state has decided on other locations around there, but a prison doesn't generate any sort of revenue either. They want it. Again, I get it. They want it. They want big factories, or they want big retail, and they want all something that's going to attract a lot more jobs than warehousing. I appreciate it. I understand why they want that, but it's not going to happen. There's no market for this in the real world. Could there be a market 10 years from now? Maybe. I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball that's like that. But so far, the only developer that's willing to come out and put their money, and they're not asking for taxpayer dollars at all, the only developer that's willing to take this nuisance property off the hands of the city is, again, it's this company, and they're saying this is how, you know, we want to use this. One of our texters says, give them a chance. That's it. Jeff, you are spot on. Wake up, Milwaukee. Jeff, remember when the city passed on Strauss, which would have been great jobs for the north side? What was Milwaukee waiting for? Well, that's it. And they're referring to out on Capitol Drive, the Century City project. Remember, you had Strauss Meats, which is a wonderful, wonderful company, who wanted to relocate some of their facilities from Franklin. They wanted to put them in this area of Capitol Drive. It's the old AMC plant, and it's just been, you know, terrible. It's been completely undeveloped. They wanted to bring this, and then you had people in the community say, well, we don't want a meat processing plant there. And so, okay, Strauss said, fine, you don't want us, we'll pull out. The worst thing in the world that could happen is right now for Northridge, for Phoenix investors to say, all right, you don't want us to buy this property? You know, you don't want us to try to do what we think is the best use for it? Fine, we'll pull out. And then you're back at square one. And square one is, you need millions of dollars to raise, that the city's going to have to come up with, to tear down the property or to try to find somebody else to do it. But if Phoenix, which knows what it's doing, if they decide that this isn't worth the dough, how is somebody else going to be worth the dough. Jeff, isn't some jobs better than 20 years of no jobs? You would think that that would be the case. But it's not ideal. You know, we want this to look like, I don't know, pick a thriving area of the country. You know, we want this to look like, you know, Naples, Florida. Well, okay, I got news for you. It ain't going to look like Naples, Florida. That's just the reality. Jeff, how about a big green park? Laugh out loud. Well, that's kind of what you're going to be looking at. Let's take a quick break. Back with more in just a minute. This is Jeff Wagner.
Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
Okay, so in one of the stories I'm looking at, the assistant city attorney, her name is Teresa Montag, and she's now apparently kind of one of the point persons on this, and so she's talking about, again, industrial storage does not promote meaningful job growth. It's not compatible with the community's redevelopment goals based on past public visioning sessions. Yeah, the neighbors would sit there. I get it. They're saying, hey, we want this hotel, and we'd like all this. We'd want Northridge of 1984 back. Okay, well, somebody needs to kind of come in and slap people around, figuratively speaking, and say, okay, this isn't 1984. You know, you have to understand, you know, what the reality is. But here's my favorite response of this. Okay, and this is the assistant city attorney quoted in the local paper. After years of neglect under Black Spruce's ownership, the city's primary aim is to anchor the properties with a catalytic project based on a holistic approach consistent with the needs and goals of the community. After years of neglect under Black Spruce's ownership, the city's primary aim is to anchor the properties with a catalytic project based on a holistic approach consistent with the needs and goals of the community. A catalytic project based on holistic approach consistent with the needs and goals of the community. I went as far as there is to go in school. I have no idea what the hell that means. A catalytic project based on an holistic approach consistent with the needs and goals of the community. Earth to the city of Milwaukee. It's the site is a disaster. It has been a disaster for 20 years. Nobody wants to invest a dime in it. This company has come along to take this off your hands. Take the deal. Declare victory. Go home. Back with more in just a minute.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the program. For one segment, let's lighten it up a little bit. Okay, Mike Spaulding.
Yes.
I'm curious as to how you would react. You and your wife, I know, go out to dinner from time to time. I have had this happen more and more. I mean, it happened. I mean, last week we were on vacation, and we were in Florida last week, Okay, it's very busy. It's spring break. It's Easter break time and stuff. And it's very difficult to get restaurant reservations at restaurants that you want to go to because it's just kind of crowded like that. And so what will happen at some of our very favorite restaurants is you will call up and to get a reservation. And what they'll say is, well, we can get you in at 5:30, for example, but we need the table at 7 o'clock. So they'll say, you know, you've got like 90 minutes and you can take it or not. As a matter of fact, and that happens, and that's a common thing at some of our very favorite restaurants around here. It's the same thing. You know, we'll call up and we'll say, hey, you know, we'd like to get in for the Friday fish fry. And, you know, the owner of the restaurant will say, well, I can get you in, but there's somebody coming in at 7. So if you can come in at 5:30 or 5, I can accommodate you, but I need the table by 7. Would you be offended if you were told that you've got essentially 90 minutes to get to get your meal?
No. No, not at all. It's actually happened here in Milwaukee before to us, and that's fine.
Yeah.
I'd rather know right away than it's 6:50 and they go, "Hey man, you're not going to be able to get dessert cuz you got to get out of here."
Well, right, but I mean as long as they tell you up front that okay, this is, and I mean I understand from the restaurant's perspective, they've got a quote-unquote turntables. You know, they've got a, if the idea is, hey, to make it go, we've got to turn this table 3 times in the course of a meal or whatever. So you would not be offended by that?
No, not at all. No.
I'm with you. I mean, because like I say, there's a couple places, particularly in Southwest Florida, that we love that are very, very busy. And unless you want to wait to eat till 8:30 or 9 o'clock when, you know, you're the last seating, but even then, I don't want to necessarily being the last one that's closing down the restaurant when they're putting that up. So you would not be offended?
No, that's okay. Like I said, I'd rather know if they tell you ahead of time,
yeah,
you have 90 minutes to eat dinner. If we don't think it's enough time, then we'll find somewhere else and maybe pick another night. But no, if you're straight up right away, that's
right,
perfectly
right,
fine.
And of course, then the commitment on the part of the restaurant is they have to serve, you know, and they have to serve you. You have to. It's not like you could sit for 30 minutes. And if there's a huge backlog in the kitchen, that might impact that. But assuming, you know, you go there knowing that. Okay, well, that's good. I agree. Now, why I'm bringing this up is because there's a huge story in the New York Post about how diners across the country are objecting to this practice. Here's the story. New York City restaurants impose a 90-minute time limit on diners. And their argument is, hey, we have diners who are just coming, and they're sitting, and they're there for like 3 hours, and they're lingering, and we can't get these tables that were there. A few weeks ago, Christina Izzo, 33, was out with a couple of friends at this particular restaurant. They asked, okay, after they have been served, after they've eaten, they'd asked to order some more food. They were told that they couldn't. The clock was ticking at the 90 minutes allotted for the reservations was nearly up, and the diner was upset. It's almost like a bodyguard ushering you out of a club after a fight. And so the story goes on to talk about how this is becoming more and more of a trait. Now, if you go to Europe, it is different in Europe, and there will be people built into, if you sit at a cafe to have a cup of coffee or something like that, built into the price, you are essentially renting the table. That's kind of what it is. And, you know, once you go and you order that coffee, they're not going to come and chase you out. But that's how, I mean, I remember when a number of years ago we were in Venice, and that was it. You can, you know, you pay for your coffee, but again, it's built in. You are renting that table, and people aren't going to come along and say you have to leave. If you want to stay there for as long as you want to stay there, you know, you have paid for that. It's different in the United States. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's our talk and text line. Here is my question. Would you be offended by this? I mean, if they tell you, yeah, we can get you in, we've got the restaurant reservation, but it's 90 minutes because we can get you in at 5:30, but we need the table at 7. And again, assuming that the meal is properly placed, assuming that the waiter or waitress comes out, you know, shortly after you sit down, you have your drink, you order your appetizer, you order your entree, and assuming that they get you in and get you served in a prompt period, would you be offended if they tell you, okay, the 90 minutes is up and now we need that table? 855-616-1620. Maybe it's partially due to the fact that my, you know, wife worked in the restaurant industry all her life, but we understand that. Matter of fact, there are times, even, you know, when we, let's say we go in and we eat at 5:30 and we're finished and we're maybe not necessarily ready to go home. Maybe we want an after-dinner drink or something, but we will commonly say to the owner or the hostess or whatever, or the waitress or waiter, do you need the table? In which case, you know, we're more than willing to go have that after-dinner drink at the bar. I mean, I don't have a problem. Again, as long as the restaurant gets you served. Now, it's one thing if, again, you've agreed to 90 minutes and you haven't had your meal until, you know, 10 minutes before that 90 minutes is up. That's a different story. But assuming it's properly paced, you object? 855-616-1620. Jeff, not at all. As a matter of fact, many years ago, my wife and I walked into a restaurant on Sweetest Day, unannounced, late afternoon. We were going to a movie at Northridge. When we walked in, the hostess looked at us and, like a deer in the headlight, asked us if we knew what day it was. Turned out to be Sweetest Day. She sat us and told us to hurry up, which was fine. We were pretty much the only early birds at the restaurant anyway. Jeff, the restaurant industry just went through a colossal trauma with the pandemic. Let them set the rules for diners, and I think 90 minutes is reasonable. Dennis and Sullivan. Dennis, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Good. Would you be offended if they told you got 90 minutes to eat?
No, not at all. I'd like to see that. My wife and I go out to eat a lot, and there's one restaurant in particular I won't name that they let the people just sit there. And one night when it got to be like 9 o'clock, we just said, the hell with this, and we left.
Well, right,
never could eat.
Yeah, because I mean, right. That's right, because Because what do you do to the people that, and you know, what do you do to the people? And the restaurant's got to make money. They have to, I mean, they've got to turn
exactly.
these tables. Yeah, no, I'm with you. Thanks for calling. Again, that's the thing. And that's why we always try to be concerned about it. I mean, and again, if it's, we try not to linger. If it's clearly a busy night, regardless of whether they have that policy or not, we try to be good customers and say, okay, well, we're done with our meal, and I'll gladly, I'm not quite ready to go home, but here, we'll go up to the bar and we'll have that second drink, or we'll have the after dinner drink or whatever, and you can have the table. I'm not offended by that at all. Now, again, I don't think it's appropriate for restaurants to rush people, but if you say up top, hey, we're going to need this table because we've got somebody else coming in at 7. As long as they can get you served, I don't have a problem on this. Let's talk to Brenda in Grafton. Brenda, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What do you think?
I do not have a problem with this because, I've been a waitress. I've been a hostess throughout my career. I mean, I haven't done it in years, but, you know, they're paid on tips, mostly on tips. And if that, some people come in and sit for hours and hours and hours, and then they don't tip very well. The table never got turned. The restaurant never made any more money than what was on there, you know, what they ordered, right? And it's very offensive, especially if the place is a really hot ticket item, right? They're trying to make hay while they can, because who knows how long you're going to be hot as a restaurant. I mean, you really have to be sensitive to all of those things as a patron. And as long as you said, as long as they get you your food and you get everything you want and you know, your drinks, right, your dinner, your appetizer, you know, whatever, dessert, then you should be totally okay with that. They have to make a living, too. Some people come in and park themselves, and they don't order much. They don't tip well. You know, it's really not fair to anyone else in that restaurant when you do that.
Right, including the people that have the 7 o'clock reservations, you know, in the restaurants. I mean,
right.
I understand there's a bit of a science to this as to, okay, how long should it take? And we want to seat people so we don't overwhelm the kitchen and all that type of stuff. But, yeah, in general, I think 90 minutes is more for at most places for most meals. 90 minutes, if properly paced, is more than enough time to eat dinner.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, thank you. I'm with you on this one. It's a big story in the New York Post, and these people are just upset with these restaurants and these policies. And I'm like, well, it's, look, if you want to, restaurants are different than like bars. If you want to go to a bar and sit around, well, that's kind of like a different sort of story. But, you know, restaurants, they depend on being able to turn tables. And now, to me, I think the common courtesy, like I say, is that once you're finished with your meal, and if there's other people waiting for the table, because that other person could be me. I could be the guy with the 7 o'clock reservations who's now looking at the people who've been served, and the plates have been cleared, and they're just sitting there, and they're talking, and they're talking, and they're talking, and I'm the one that wants to go, hey, I want the table now. You know, I've got the 7 o'clock reservation. Go to the bar. You know, continue your conversation. Nobody's saying that you've got to go home, but move it along. That's kind of how I feel as well. Back with more in just a minute. This is Jeff Wagner, WTMJ. So, very glad to have you with me. If you follow me on Twitter, it's at JeffWagner620. I had a number of postings when I was on vacation, but posted this one last night. A really interesting story. It's being reported on Fox 6. Here is the deal. The guy's name is Vincent King. He's 30 years old. He is accused, allegedly, so we'll put that allegedly. Allegedly, what he did was in November. Okay, so what happens is he's driving 60 miles an hour over the speed limit. He crashes into a SUV. He kills the driver. The driver is a 71-year-old man, and he seriously injures a passenger in his own vehicle. Okay, so that's kind of the deal. The data from his car says that he was driving 94 miles an hour, posted speed limit 35, and he crashes into the 71-year-old man's car, kills the 71-year-old man. All right, so you've got the deal. He, by the way, he is a felon, and they find that there's a gun in the car. So he's a felon. He's in possession of a firearm. He's driving 94 miles an hour in a 35-mile-an-hour zone. He crashes into an SUV, and he kills a 71-year-old man. All right, it gets better. So what happens is, after the crash, he's taken to the hospital because he's injured. For reasons that nobody can explain, this is November of last year, the Milwaukee Police Department loses track of him after they stop guarding him at his hospital room. All right, so I can't explain this. So driving 94 miles an hour, hits and kills somebody, felon in possession of a gun. They take him to the hospital, and they stop. The cops stop watching him, and so he just walks away, and he goes on the lam. And they find him about a month later in Texas. Okay, so they bring him back. So you've got dead 71-year-old man. You've got a felon in possession of a gun who is also severely injured by driving 94 miles an hour, a passenger in his own vehicle. So the family of the 71-year-old man is obviously extremely, unhappy with this entire situation. Well, to add insult to injury, the DA's office, this is the John Chisholm DA's office, reaches out to them. Now, the defendant, he's looking at a maximum sentence of nearly 50 years. Felon in possession, somebody dead because he's driving 94 miles an hour, somebody else seriously injured. So the family reaches out to, in this case, Channel 6 News, and says, hey, we got this letter from the quote-unquote victim witness advocate at the DA's office, which is kind of an oxymoron. And they say, here's the deal. The district attorney, they want to cut a plea deal with this guy, and they want to allow him to serve time for both charges concurrently. In other words, you get sentenced on killing the 71-year-old man. You get sentenced on the serious injury that you caused the other person, but you get to serve both of those sentences together. So it's not like you did both things. In addition, prosecutors say they would drop the gun charge. They would drop the gun charge. So they say, hey, this is what we're going to do. Well, the family goes public with this. God bless them. The family says, we don't want a plea deal. It's absolutely off the table if they ask for it. The family, we don't want you cutting a deal with this guy. We don't want you giving away significant stuff. We want a trial. He killed our father. He killed a 71-year-old man. He's a felon in possession of a gun. We're objecting to this. Now, this is the type of stuff that happens all the time. But what's unique is you have this family that's going public with this story. It also underscores one of these ongoing problems, which is felon in possession of a gun. This is a charge that the DA's office will regularly get rid of, to which my point is, why? Why do we have these penalties? Everybody complains about gun violence, appropriately so. Everybody should complain about people who aren't legally allowed to carry firearms, namely felons, carrying guns. And yet this always ends up being one of the charges that just thrown away like, 4-day-old sweet rolls. We're going to get rid of this. Why in the world, you've got a, no pun intended, dead bang winner case here. You've got this guy driving 94 miles an hour. He's in possession of the gun. Boom. Why in the world would you drop this? Now, you might say, well, because, we want him to plea and we don't want this matter to go to trial. Okay, this, it doesn't sound like you need rocket science to get a conviction in this particular case. Why would you give away gun charges? And yet these gun charges are just thrown out regularly. I'm a guy, and we'll be talking more about this week, who believes that, now is the time, if the Republicans in the legislature want to try to get back some initiative, now's the time to roll out some really significant anti-crime measures, which is, for example, mandatory minimum penalties for felons that carry guns. But the weakness is always going to be when you've got DAs like John Chisholm that will just throw these charges out. And at least I give this family credit because they're saying, no, we don't want this case plea bargained. We want the person to be put on trial, and we want, him to be held fully accountable. Now, if the judge decides that he wants to run all the sentences concurrently, well, then the judge gets to do it. Then we can have our beef with the judge. But we don't want the DA's office just giving away the case. I don't think that's too much to ask. And if you want to see more about the story, you can follow me on Twitter. It's at JeffWagner620.
Welcome back to Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
Breaking news, of course, with the shooting at the bank in Louisville. Apparently, one of the people shot was a police officer, shot in the head. And apparently, they said he just graduated from the police academy a couple days ago. More details are emerging on that.
Welcome back to Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
I've been meaning to talk about this case since the news broke last week, but with the information from over the weekend on Saturday that the two police officers in northwestern Wisconsin were shot, and we started off the program talking about this. I always cringe when I see the phrase routine traffic stop, because there is no such thing as routine traffic stop, especially there never has been, but especially, you know, not anymore, because you just never know what's going to happen. And at least around here, on just all too regular basis, you go to pull somebody over because their taillight's out or because they don't have a license plate or whatever. And what happens? The default position appears to be run, lead the cops on a high-speed chase, and then you're kind of off to the races. And this, what happened to these two officers in northwest Wisconsin just really underscores the fact that anytime you are involved in a situation with somebody, you don't know what you're getting into. And it may very well be somebody that's armed and is ready to just get in a shootout. And you don't know that as a police officer, which brings me to this story of an individual who was shot and killed on February 21st. Now, you might remember the story from, you know, about a month and a half ago. The guy's name was Herman Lucas. In 2010, Herman Lucas was convicted, pled guilty to first-degree reckless injury. In that case, Lucas was just feet away when he pointed a gun at his girlfriend, and the weapon fired, striking her in the face. She survived. Lucas claimed it was an accident. All right? At the time this event that we're going to talk about in just a minute happened, he also had a warrant out for his arrest in a case in Waukesha County for providing misappropriate identity information to obtain money. All right, so that's the deal. But anyways, this is, you know, what happened. About 1:48 p.m., February 21st, the 7,000 block of West Thurston Avenue on Milwaukee's northwest side, police officers pull over a vehicle driven by Lucas because it doesn't have license plates on it. What happens is Lucas stops the car, the cops get out, and then he floors it. He takes off as the officers approach on foot. So the officers call this in, and they get back in the car, and they're chasing him. The chase goes for about a mile and a half. Lucas blows through the red light and crashes into another car, 91st and Silver Spring. And Silver Spring, one of the major, you know, east-west thoroughfares here, 91st and Silver Spring, that's just a little bit east of the U.S. 41, the freeway over there. Okay, so at that point in time, you've now run from the cops, you've led them on a high-speed chase, you've blown through a red light, you've smashed into another car. Well, what do you do? Well, Lucas, who is, by the way, a convicted felon, gets out of the car carrying a gun and starts running. So he's running. He's got a gun with him. The cops are chasing him now on foot. He's running through a gas station parking lot, and they've got video of this. The officer is yelling, "Drop the gun, drop the gun." He doesn't drop the gun. And then what happens is Lucas tries to climb over a fence. He's trying to scale a fence. An officer closes in, and you can hear him yelling, "Drop the gun, drop the gun." Lucas doesn't drop the gun, but he does turn towards the police. And at that time, you know, one of the officers shoot. So he's trying to scale the fence. He falls down. He has his back turned at the officer, but he's turning to face him as the officer approached. The officer shoots him multiple times. So there's a video of that that's out there. Now, you can't see for sure what Lucas is doing with the gun, although he still has it. I mean, he's still got it in his possession, and he's turning. And once he turns with the gun, the officer shoots him. All right. Now, this, you might remember this story because it got a lot of attention, because after Lucas went down, this was the one where the police officers then came up and they started to they dragged the body a little bit. And this is when one of the bystanders, everybody's got their cell phone cameras out, and, you know, they see them moving the body, and they're dragging the body, and they're kicking the gun from away from where he had it. And there's people who are saying, well, maybe they handled that inappropriately. I think that that's kind of been rejected. But now the story is, well, we're investigating this because, you know, the police officer shot this guy who did all this stuff. He's running with a gun in his hand, and he starts to turn. And, well, now there's some question about, was he pointing the gun at the officer or not? Our number is 855-616-1620. Look, here is the bottom line here. Being a police officer is a very, very dangerous job, more dangerous now than perhaps any time in the history of this country. And the bottom line of this is, you know, first of all, if you don't want to have problems, well, don't be a felon in possession of a gun. If you don't want to have problems, you know, don't drive around without license plates on your car. If you don't want to have problems, don't flee from the police when they try to pull you over. If you don't want to have problems, don't run through red lights at high rates of speed and crash into cars. If you don't want to have a problem, don't get out of the car carrying the gun that you're not legally allowed to have. Ignore the police instructions to drop the gun and run away from the cops. And then, of course, don't, you know, turn to the police with the gun in your hand. What is a police officer supposed to do? Our number, 855-616-1620. This has been another one of these infuriating things, and it's under investigation. But for anybody, at least in my opinion, to look at these circumstances and even suggest that the police did something wrong in this particular case is absurd. The guy shouldn't have had the gun. He shouldn't have been running from the police. He shouldn't have led him on a high-speed chase. He should have dropped the gun when instructed. And when you do all these things, at some point in time, you got to recognize that officers have to make a split-second decision. And the reason this man is dead is not because of misconduct by the police officer. Instead, it's because you had a bad guy who had many, 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 many chances to try to deflect this, and he failed in all those cases. And I don't think the officer has to wait till the guy turns and fires a couple rounds at him before he exercises his right to use, in this case, deadly force. 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment.
Welcome back to Jeff Wagner on WTMJ.
For everybody out there who wants to second-guess the actions of police, what you need to realize is it's a different time nowadays. And you're dealing on a regular basis, in some cases in urban areas, on an almost daily basis, with people who are felons, with people who you have to presume who are armed, and with people who you have to presume not only are armed but are willing to use those guns. And, you know, I don't think police officers need to be wait to be shot before they get to use deadly force. Now, I mean, I'm not promoting vigilantism and things like that, but I'm looking at this story here where you've got the guy who's running from the police. He's carrying a gun. He's ignoring the police's instructions to drop it, and he's turning towards the cops. Now, I don't know what he would have done, but if he would have thrown down the gun in the first place, you know, and then even continue to try to flee, that might be a different story. But when he's carrying a gun and he starts to turn towards the police, yes, I am sorry. I think it's shoot first and ask questions later. And you have nobody to blame but, in this case, the felon who shouldn't have been in that situation in the first place. JD in Michigan, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, sir. Hey, listen to you all the time.
Thank you.
You come right across the pond. You're a voice of reason in a sea of stupidity.
Well, thank you.
And I thank you for it. But I'm a retired law enforcement, and when there's an officer-involved shooting, there are multiple reviews. There's an internal. Of course, you're being tried in the media, public opinion. Then the state departments will come in. In my case, it would be Florida Department of Law Enforcement and possibly Department of Justice. And the people that are deciding this are sitting in a nice, comfortable room. They're in a soft, nice chair, air-conditioned, heated. They got water. They're talking. That officer was not. That officer had to make a split-second decision. And the people in that room cannot possibly judge a key element to use force, jeopardy. How can they feel that officer's jeopardy?
Yeah, right. And in this case, so, in this case, JD, there's not even a question. This isn't, did the guy have a gun or not? He had a gun. He was refusing the police officer's instructions to drop that gun while he was fleeing, and he was starting to turn towards the officer. Now, I don't know if we'll ever know whether his intention was to surrender or not, but it doesn't matter. As long as you've got that gun in your hand, you know, if he had done any one of a number of things, starting with not running from the police, dropping the gun, etc., he would be alive today. But when you force the police officer's hand, well, okay, play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
Well, the weapon's the threat. If the officer feels jeopardy, it's justified, and it's not even questionable.
Yeah.
In a reasonable person mind, did that officer feel in jeopardy of great bodily harm or death,
right,
then it's justified.
Yep.
So you factor in those in most police shootings, sir, and the officers acted appropriate. Most.
Yeah.
There are cases, and you've reviewed some of them,
sure,
but you're spot on here. It starts with the conduct of the actor.
Right. And thanks for calling. Right. No, you're right. No, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to cut you go. But, right, you just... You have to, you know, let those things out there. You know, one of our texters is saying, well, let them go. You can't let somebody go. Okay. You can't let somebody run from the police, drive through an intersection at 90 some miles an hour, slam into a car, get out carrying a gun and run away. You can't just let them go. Because what do you think is going to happen? You know, when he gets away from the police carrying that gun, when that person goes and shoots somebody else, how are you going to explain, oh, we had a chance to bring him in? No, in this particular case, anytime there is a death, it is unfortunate, it is tragic, right? But it is precipitated by the bad guys. And I guess I am just sick to death of that element of our society, and I don't think it's a majority of people out there who want to view the police as the bad guys. They want to view the police as the occupying force, when the truth of the matter is you have criminals out there that are getting more and more bold on a daily basis, and they're demonstrating that they don't care about other people. They're willing to steal people's cars and shoot people and do whatever they want to do to be able to get what it is that they want. And they have, unfortunately, no hesitation at shooting police officers. And that means we have to recognize that police officers need to be particularly attuned to this. And like I say, I don't think you need to wait until somebody has fired a couple rounds at you before you return fire. And the message to the bad guys ought to be, if you want to make sure that nothing bad happens to you, pull over. You know, first of all, don't commit crimes. But secondly, pull over when the police try to pull you over. Don't flee. Drop your guns. Surrender. Do the right thing. Let the court system take over. But once you decide to set this chain of events in motion, bad, bad things can happen, and it's not the fault of the cops. Okay, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll find out what John and Sandy have on their minds for Wisconsin's Afternoon News. Well, good to be back in the studio. Good to be back from vacation. It's 2:56. Sandy Max, John Mercure.
How was Easter? You and Fran have a nice Easter.
Easter was wonderful. We went out and hosted a number of our relatives and stuff, so it was good to see. And I ate way too much, but that's what Easter's all about.
That's what
right?
it's all about.
And I a lot of church and went to church. I was on vacation, went to Good Friday services at 3 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning. I was at Easter Sunday, so I was good.
What was your favorite part of your Easter feast?
Oh, I ate pretty much everything there was. There was my wife was kind of looking at me. I said, "Oh, I had the prime rib. I had the ham. I had the omelet. I had the crab legs, and that's just getting started."
Did you cook, or were you in the restaurant?
We were in a restaurant. We were in the restaurant.
So the best part about that is, too, you will not be eating ham the next 5 days like some of us will be.
Well, I thought you'd say the best part is not having to clean up.
That's good too.
It was all good.
So I went to the grocery store. Michelle and I are the only two at home, and I saw a beautiful little 4-pound ham. Looked perfect. And it was $27. At Kroger, then they had the 12-pound ham on sale, and it was $9. So I said, well, I gotta get the 12. I'm an idiot if I don't get the bigger ham, right? No, I'm gonna have ham I wish I had gotten the baby ham now, because I'm gonna have ham this, ham that, ham the other thing, ham in the freezer.
Have you ever gone to the honey-baked ham store?
Yes, with the crunchy...
I love the honey baked ham store. Yeah. And you go there at Christmas and there's a line around the block to get there.
Oh, but that's good.
Honey baked ham. That was my one regret for Easter, because I'm like, hey, maybe we should have people over and get a big old honey baked ham.
Yep.
That's my free ad, but I love honey.
Well, I got ham if you need it. I will hook you up.
John baked ham.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, coming up on the show, we've got a lot of stuff that we're covering, some important stories that have new developments this afternoon. And they're not great stories, but important to keep you up to speed on Louisville, a shooting inside a bank. New information is coming out, and a press conference is scheduled for this afternoon, which you will hear here on WTMJ. Also closer to home, Cameron, that's in Barron County, kind of northwest Wisconsin. Two police officers from very small departments shot and killed in a brutal attack during a traffic stop. So we will give you perspective on that. We will check in with a reporter who's there on the scene. And also Steve Peterson, a former SWAT member in Waukesha County and law enforcement expert, will be with us to walk us through that situation during the 5 o'clock hour. Also, a new phone area code is coming to Wisconsin. It seems like we're doing this every few years now. We're going to tell you where that area code is, how it'll be implemented, and all that sort of thing. So we've got a lot of information coming up on the show this afternoon.
Looking
forward to
it.
Newsy stuff, weathery stuff, we have got you covered. It's Wisconsin's Afternoon News on WTMJ.